Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. And this week, we're happy to have Roslyn Layton joining us. Roslyn and I worked together at AEI when I was over there, and she's still affiliated with AEI, as well as working in a multidisciplinary program in the engineering school in Aalborg University in Copenhagen. Roslyn, yours is one of the names that's being bandied about as a potential FCC commissioner. Are you up for that?
Well, I think there's a number of names floating around. I mean, obviously, it would be an honor to have that opportunity. But in any case, I will do everything I can in my personal professional capacity to see a vision of the FCC be realized and, you know, bring broadband to all Americans.
Well, I think we all do what we can. I'm actually on one of the working groups on the BDAC, on the Municipal Codes Working Group. So I'll be having my first meeting with them on this coming Friday. Looking forward to that.
Excellent.
There's a lot of work to do over there.
Oh, yes.
So you just got your PhD from Aalborg University in Denmark. And your research topic was about evaluating open internet frameworks for specifically mobile platforms and evaluating their effectiveness in terms of promoting innovation. Is that right?
Yes.
And so what did you find out?
Well, you know, for one thing, I've had a great opportunity over 4 years to work in the research environment in Denmark. There's a public-private partnership with the Danish government for the last 40 years, looking at kind of key questions for society. And it's particularly interesting because Denmark, which is, you know, perhaps the number one or number two digital nation in the world, had self-regulation for net neutrality going back to 2011. So they really had a vision for a long time, even before, about what I call classic telecom regulation, which is the goal of telecom regulation is to move a market from full monopoly to full competition, and at which time...
And that's an extremely acute problem in Europe where most of the telephone networks, I think without exception, the telephone networks were all government-owned until the 90s, right?
Correct. Well, Denmark actually was different even from its Scandinavian neighbors because they wanted complete privatization of their incumbent telephone network, which they facilitated in 1994. In fact, they even sold off, AT&T or Bell South, I think, was one of the buyers in the privatization, no longer an owner today. But the liberalization and privatization was led by the Social Democrats. A very interesting story, which is for 20 years, there has been a very similar to U.S., not just a bipartisan, but a multi-party telecom policy that wanted to move the market from a monopoly to full competition and return it to a kind of place of antitrust and competition law. The Danes don't believe that they can add value by micromanaging networks, and they believe that the market would do a better job at delivering the various broadband options. So, in fact, in 2011, these Social Democrats dismantled the telecom regulator. It no longer exists today, and the employees were distributed across four different agencies. So what is left of what was the telecom authority is now a section in the sort of Danish Business Authority. It's like a Department of Commerce.
So this would be like if we were to take the FCC and merge it into the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. Would that be a fair analogy?
Well, similarly, but then they did recognize a role for cybersecurity. So a lot of the employees were moved into to strengthen the cybersecurity function. They recognized that back in 2010 that the cybersecurity, you know, which I have to say is, you know, even, you know, we've been struggling with that in the United States, trying to get our act together. And the Danes see themselves as a small nation. There are a lot of threats in the world, and they take this very seriously. So they have put their best minds on telecommunication into the cybersecurity function. There is a lot of respect for the government employees in Denmark. They have lifetime employment, but they also have to be able to be flexible to change jobs and agencies, to move to other parts of the country. So there is it's a very different view about what it means to be a government employee, but you also have to have skills. And this has been driven by high labor cost. So there's no idea that, you know, you're going to improve government by adding headcount. You need to do it through intelligent workforce as well as digital solutions. So this whole idea is that going forward, the bureaucracy cannot grow in size. It can only grow in efficiency. It needs to, if anything, will shrink because a lot of positions are no longer filled. So there are no more receptionists, for example. All communication has to be digital with your, you know, municipality and so on. Sorry, I know I've taken us off track, so I can get us back on track again. So looking at, shall I jump into the research?
Yeah, I mean, because you did the overview of the different net neutrality regimes in countries that have adopted them and listed some of the major countries that have not adopted net neutrality regimes. And then you compared the innovation using a metric that you devised, compared innovation in countries that were comparable in most respects, but differed in terms of their approach to net neutrality, right? So
right.
That would be Denmark and the Netherlands?
That's right. So let me take one step back and I'll say that. I used to work in Silicon Valley in the analytics industry. So when I came into the policy world, I was sort of flummoxed by why people were having so many debates because I said, well, why don't you just look at the data? You don't need to debate these issues very clearly if, in fact, your policy is supposed to bring more innovation. We have now 50 countries in the world with some kind of net neutrality rules for a period of 5 years or more. Why don't we just look at which ones have done a better job? Now, that should be easy on the surface to do. But many cases, you know, countries will say, well, we need these rules for innovation. They don't specify what kind of innovation and how and where and how.
Well, and there's also a lot of, they're confounding factors, right? Because there are, you know, other factors besides net neutrality regulations that influence innovation.
Of course. Well, but in any case, my premise is simply that we should be able to look at the countries with net neutrality rules before and after rules were in place, and the ones that after rules are in place, there should be more edge provider innovation, if you will. If we're going to take what the U.S. Considers to be more important, you know, that there should be more apps in the economy or more edge providers, then that's the case. Let's just count before and after. We'll look at the top 250 apps in each market, which account for almost 99% of the traffic. So you can get a valuable measurement. So there are actually tools which you can use to measure these things. I use two different software sets. One is called Apptopia, which is a commercial grade. It's the leading market research tool for the global app market. And I also used, it's called App Annie. And I also used another software called Apptopia. So between using those two software platforms, I was measuring the app development over a five-year period in Denmark and the Netherlands before and after. And I was specifically interested to see, after rules had been in place, and what kind of rules, which countries were more successful to produce more apps from their own economies, as well as, you know, the number of, the number of apps, the number of publishers. And what I found was 5 years hence, Denmark had essentially improved by about one-third where they were before, whereas the Netherlands fell by one-third. So 5 years hence, after a period using self-regulation in Denmark, the Danes have produced world-class exported apps from their own country, games that are this one of the top 10 games in the world, Subway Surfers. They've produced a number of category killer apps in areas which not only Danes use, but people around the world use. But there were no such developments from the Netherlands. I can tell you right now, you probably can't name any app that you use that was made in Holland. So now, of course, I know there's got to be more going on than this. But as a policymaker, if I had stood up and said, we're going to make these rules so we get more innovation, well, I would be very keen. 5 years later, I better be right. Or I shouldn't make such a law.
Well, yeah. And Netherlands is one of the countries that has been showered with praise from American net neutrality advocates for not only having these really strict net neutrality regulations, but also spending a lot of government money on fiber optic networks, right? So don't they? I mean,
If anything, things should be better in the Netherlands, because not only do they have, they've got two lines to every home, they have four mobile networks, they have also fiber networks in some places, but they're sitting on an internet exchange.
Well, it's the major internet exchange in Europe, right? Like pretty much all the traffic between European countries goes through Amsterdam.
Well, there's not a mass exodus of app developers to go to Amsterdam, for one thing. I mean, how we do have a lot of app developers who want to come to Copenhagen, that's for sure. But there's basically, I would say for this policy, if the goal was to get more Dutch-made innovation, it hasn't worked. Now, there may be other things that people want from the rules. I certainly don't deny that. They somehow believe that this is freedom of choice or free speech, et cetera, et cetera. But those things haven't been measured either. So in any case, what I'm just trying to do
is... if the discourse is just battling anecdotes, then we don't need to measure anything, right?
Yeah, but I'm of this, fuddy-duddy school that says, if you make a policy, you should have some kind of way to measure whether it works, and you should have some way to measure whether you're on track. I mean, here we have 50 countries with net neutrality rules. How do you know that they're working? You should be able to independently verify that the policy works. So in any case, the other interesting thing in my research is I looked at the world and organized them in sort of three buckets. Countries which chose soft rules, which were voluntary methods, which include multi-stakeholder model, the way that we manage the internet globally through internet governance. I looked at voluntary agreements, principles and codes of conduct. I looked at hard rules, which are like legislation or regulation. And then I looked at countries with no rules at all. I mean, they may be contemplating them, but they haven't put them forth. The interesting thing is there's some 10, 12 countries that have used soft rules, and they're Japan, South Korea, the Nordic countries, Switzerland, UK. They have had actually great results over the period of time. No litigation, little to no violation. So those things actually work. And there's a lot of power that the regulator has through soft rules, because you have a carrot and stick. You have the kind of sort of Damocles to hold over the industry and say, if you act up, I'm coming for you. But so that is actually a very viable that we have observed going back to 2009, and a number of countries have had those regimes. You have countries now with hard rules, particularly in Latin America. I think this is really something that we need to be honest about. Countries such as Brazil and Chile have had hard rules on the books, for a number of years. They have no local app economies to speak of. Less than 1% of their traffic goes to apps that are made locally. There's very limited app development locally. So those rules have not been helping those particular countries to develop their own innovation. And finally, you need to look at countries that have had no rules at all, like China, which is killing it in terms of innovation. Mm-hmm. There is now more downloads to Chinese apps than American. And that happened as of May last year. China has now surpassed United States in the app market and is on track to surpass it in revenue as well. Importantly as well, when you look at countries like Japan and South Korea, don't have any interest to make hard rules. They would never dream of putting a ban on paid prioritization. They want their video game makers to be able to use all of the network technologies available to make the next set of games. They want to be the first with 5G. They're not going to say to their, their local providers, hey, we're going to limit your ability to use the network. They just don't think in those terms. They are much more competitive in terms of wanting to win globally, and they want to empower their local innovators to have all of the capabilities at the hand.
Well, does some of this possibly relate to unbundling policies? Because, going back to the beginning, net neutrality was a response that Tim Wu came up with to the fact that we were not going to have unbundled broadband networks in the U.S. We're going to have facilities-based competition between cable and telephone networks, and then any network that anyone else like Google wanted to build. And so the net neutrality regime was created to ensure that we had good behavior. But in these other countries, is there the feeling that the ISPs are disciplined by competition that takes place because of unbundling, or is that actually a mirage?
So I think that's a very good question. One of the regressions that I make in my research is I'm looking at the number of mobile networks. So I'm actually counting for, you know, countries that have multiple advanced mobile networks. And that is important, but it's not, you know, statistically significant.
Oh, well, yeah, you're focused on mobile, so unbundling
right.
is not
right.
really
so, yeah, so I I wish that I could have done this study on the fixed line networks, but there wasn't a measurement that I could use for the 50 countries because not all of them, you know, as you know, developing countries are primarily using mobile networks. But there is a point which I think, for me, what explains the difference between the Netherlands and Denmark? Why is it that the levels of innovation are so divergent? Is basically that the Danes have enjoyed more commercial freedom in selling mobile subscriptions. They have been using free data for more than 10 years. They are very aggressive. The mobile operators partner with local content providers to encourage people to adopt networks, to adopt data packages, to adopt next generation technologies. So going back to, so you can see this about one third higher rate of people using on their smartphones were using a postpaid data package in Denmark versus Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So the critical mass of users who are ready and available to take on the next kind of app, there's just a greater propensity that they will do it in Denmark than in Holland. And what does that mean for America? Which means the more flexibility that you give your operators, whether broadband providers, to sell broadband subscriptions, the better off it is for the innovators in that economy, because you increase the user base for whom they can get their apps to, and however you can get them on board, that is the whole. The idea of this, and this is the foundation of two-sided markets, which talks about allowing a whole diverse set of users and a diverse set of providers being able to get on board in whatever efficient ways that they can. And if you simply restrict through what you're doing with open internet rules, ironically, you're restricting the ability for how users can pay. They can only buy service in one way. You're restricting the ability of the innovators who may need to have different kinds of quality of service, different kinds of marketing arrangements. So ironically, those rules are lessening the ways that people can get on board. And it, you know, fortunately, it helps established players because it already works for them. And if you restrict the ways to entry and onboarding, it only serves to help the entrenched players. I mean, the other interesting thing I notice in my research is that the countries that have had the hardest net neutrality rules have the least amount of traffic diversity. So I would have assumed countries with hard net neutrality rules had a lot of traffic to lots of different kind of sites, but instead you find the usual suspects take the bulk of the internet traffic.
Well, and this is a criticism that I hear from free market folks about net neutrality in general, is that it, whatever the intentions are and however it's positioned, what it actually becomes in practice is sort of an incumbency protection program that protects not only the incumbent networks, but also the incumbent edge service companies. I mean, the concentration of the edge services market, especially for internet advertising in the United States, is becoming pretty extreme, right? It's over 90% of all the new internet ads are sold by Google or Facebook.
That's correct.
Another argument that I hear is that the free data is a way that a new app, a new startup, can get some visibility and get some people using the app, where it sort of lowers the barriers to experimentation, because if people are kind of worried about using up their data, you don't have to do that if the app has made a deal with your carrier and you can try it out for free. Is that the way you see that working in Denmark?
So the example I like to use is Spotify. And I would say that there's a little bit more complexity to that discussion about the apps, because it's more than just free data. The issue there is that let's take, you know, the probably one of the only European apps that people know of, and it's a very successful app, which is Spotify, which actually got going by using a number of non-neutral techniques. They partnered with various mobile operators because what Spotify learned was people who join for free to Spotify tend not to upgrade. And this was kind of in the early days. But if you had offered premium Spotify when at the moment when you're paying your mobile bill and it's only another $10 or whatever, you're more likely to pay. So this is, you know, what very simply, you know, in business is the cost of customer acquisition. It is the user's cost to upgrade, and you're already in the moment when you're paying for something, your credentials are on there. And what Spotify was able to leverage from the mobile operators was the billing system, was the distribution network, was the marketing. And if Spotify didn't have that, they would never be the company that they are today. They needed to have that to get the money in the door to fund their growth. Now, today, they don't care about mobile operators. They don't need to because they partner across the board. And if anything, they've kind of turned back on the very, you know, flexible technologies that allowed that to them to be successful. But it's not to say this will work for every app, but it's simply the freedom. If you are an app maker, that you can have the freedom to partner with one actor in your ecosystem. And so the other thing that happened in the Netherlands was that they essentially said that the telecom sector was not allowed to make partnerships with other players. And that essentially removes a whole important part of your ecosystem from the app makers. So you, in fact, disempower.
Yeah, so it's this idea that there has to be a firewall between the network and the applications, and everybody has to stay on their side of the wall, and they're not allowed to know anything or do any cooperation with the other side. But in reality, I mean, they're partners. I mean, people buy the, you know, that didn't Tom Wheeler tout this virtuous circle where,
of course,
you know, you build networks to run apps, and then people run apps, and that gives you incentive to upgrade your network. And,
right.
And, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship. I mean, nobody needs an app if they don't have a phone, and nobody needs a phone if they don't have apps.
Well, the other thing that struck me in my research of going through, I've collected the rules, net neutrality rules of these 50 countries and all the background, how do they make their rules and the various processes. And never in one case did you have, you know, one of the national institutes of science of any of these countries that made a study of how does internet innovation work so that they could certify that the internet works in this way and that this policy will ensure. And even in the United States, for all of our national institutes of science, they have never studied this question. And even in the case of the European Union, the official research arm of the European Commission pronounced an ecosystem model of innovation. So this idea that there's an ecosystem where there's symbiotic relationships with the different actors. But net neutrality policy is essentially saying there's not an ecosystem. There's one actor which is deterring the ability for the other actors to operate, and therefore we must control one actor, is completely antithetical to the notion of an ecosystem. So,
well, and there is a lot of research that, you know, people in academic and semi-academic institutions around the world have been trying to figure out the dynamics of internet innovation for a long time. There's, you know, these studies that are done periodically by organizations like INSEAD, and I think the Davos people do them, and ITIF does them, where they look at, try to, you know, build a scorecard of innovation in different countries and then look at the different factors to find out through regression analysis what actually is producing the outcomes.
Well, it's, you know, that's part of why I was just astounded when I came to looking at the FCC's. They didn't look at any of that. They just invented their own model that's never been discussed in the literature anywhere. They made it up. And said, this is how it works. So I said, how can that possibly be?
The virtuous circle idea is actually comes from a comment that some company filed with the FCC. It was an apps company, or maybe it was a network equipment company. And it was just sort of an off the top of the head kind of, well, we think it's like this. You know, there's this circle, but.
Right. Well, it's the other thing I learned in my research is that the, you know, fuddy-duddies like me, they come to it with this notion of there's a linear process to make policy. You know, you identify a problem, you present possible solutions, you weigh the costs and benefits of the various solutions, you look at, you know, how to measure it and so on. The way the policy process works is you decide the outcome in advance and you make your policy, and then later on you figure out what's the evidence for it. So, you know, that's our world we live in. It's a policy entrepreneurship world. And you know, for those who can think up of the idea that sounds very salient, and if you can make a winning argument, so there you are, you're off to the races. It is a very different...
Well, I mean, and if your goal is to establish the correctness of your policy by the number of comments that are filed through forms on the web with the FCC or even by bots, then it's kind of a different metric of success than if you're looking at improving the economy and improving quality of life and any of those boring old things like that. Well, we have had some... We've had some fairly mystifying behavior since, just in, I've only really followed the FCC since net neutrality became an issue. And I've, there were things like the Kevin Martin enforcement action against Comcast to enforce rules that had never been through the rulemaking process. You know, things like, it was just sort of, this is not, you know, this is not going anywhere. And, you know, it was, they were basically left out of court.
Well, I think that what it shows is that there's no, you know, there's no one better party or the other. I mean, both parties have abused this agency over the years. And, you know, the bottom line for me is, to the extent that you can keep it within the rules, to the extent that Congress provides oversight, that it only does the things which Congress has instructed it to do, the better off everyone is. I mean, in general, this is the problem with sector-specific agencies is that they are lobbied and they are very politicized. One of the things I mentioned about Denmark with the, you know, with the dismantling of their telecom regulator, the staff said, you know what's great? You know, when they had moved to other places, no one gets lobbied anymore, because they used to be that the incumbents would lobby against the entrants and the entrants lobby against the incumbents. And they said, it's so great. We don't have politicized regulation. And in fact, we can make better telecom policy. You can actually discharge your telecom laws. You don't have to have a politicized regulator to do it. You can discharge it through a variety of branches of government. You know, and we see, again, we've seen this now in Denmark for over 5 years, and it's only gotten better in that country in terms of, you know, the competition.
I mean, it sounds too good to be true, because it's, I mean, I think at this point, the FCC is so shell-shocked from losing in court on net neutrality, you know, they've done it twice now, that they embraced Title II, not because it was a wise policy, but just because they thought it was the only way they could write an order that they could get through the D.C. Circuit.
Right. Well,
and when you're writing policy defensively like that, it's just because you're leery of losing a court case. You know, who's got time to think about the impact of the policy on the internet ecosystem? I mean, your goals are narrowed so much by the fact that they're dealing with in an extremely ambiguous part of the law and have to adopt a defensive strategy to claim a success.
You're right about that. And what else does it say about the institutional focus? You know, there are opportunity costs. You know, if you have 600 lawyers at the FCC and barely, you know, not even 60 economists, you know, and, you know, however many, a few hundred, maybe 200 some engineers, that really says something about your priorities. You know, you're trying to be a rulemaking agency to produce politicized policies. That means you're not creating the next spectrum auction. You know, you're not doing broadband deployment. Mm-hmm. You're not studying market power. You know, you're not working on competition. You're not working on consumer protection.
Yeah. Well, but that's a somewhat larger problem than even the FCC. I mean, I know there are a number of people who've been involved in telecom for a very long time in D.C. on both sides of the aisle, who are just annoyed by the fact that net neutrality for the last 10 years has really sucked all the oxygen out of the room in terms of telecom policy. And there's a lot of issues like the ones you just mentioned that need more attention, not just from the FCC, but from the policy community in general, that we've been unable to focus on because, you know, about 80% of all the discussion that takes place when you get to Washington Telecom walks together is about net neutrality.
Well, and what I would say is it's a small ball strategy, and I think it has really disturbed us, because in the big picture, in many cases, it's not going to matter how we regulate, because within 5 years, I see all of our apps being Chinese anyway. So, you know, I mean, this is because we are here fighting out a stupid battle, and the whole world has become a global marketplace for the internet. And whether you want to take this in and you want to fight over some antique rule from 1934, or you want to see the reality today, which is are we competitive as a nation? You'd probably change your rulemaking priorities with that in mind.
Well, folks are pretty dug in on this issue now, and it just seems like the more we talk about it, the more polarized it gets. I just pray for some sort of a resolution that is, satisfies at least the major objectives of the warring camps. If there really is an objective beyond just keeping the war going, I think there are a lot of people who benefit just from that.
Right.
But
it is, I would say on the positive side, I think it is valuable. For example, you're in High Tech Forum, you have there is a subset of people who do care about data. There are people who do care about getting it right, the facts. I think in Americans in general, when you talk to them about this issue, they're certainly concerned about, those kind of, not being able to, they want to be able to enjoy a free and open internet, but they're not really excited about the government regulating it. That doesn't really, excite people. And if anything, those who are still remembering, Snowden surveillance, they should really not be excited about the government regulating the internet. But in any case, I'm positive that there is a room for real dialogue, even with people who are, very dug in on this issue, to bring the data to the table and to go back to those policymakers who insist that this is that this will work. Then I think they should, the burden is on them to show us the data that it does. I mean, to date,
Maybe you need to pay a call on John Oliver and see if you can convince him that there's some humor to be found in a healthy internet, and he can generate laughs. He can, use his chosen colorful vocabulary and, get people excited about just better apps, more apps. How about that?
Yeah,
interesting
idea. I hadn't thought of the John Oliver order. Perhaps that's a way to call it.
Yeah. I think that whole thing started with a lobbyist actually, who got to a staff member of Oliver's and fed him the story.
Yeah.
But
otherwise, I don't think he'd ever talk about that on his show.
Yeah, that was the funny thing, was that anyone who's outside the community of policy wonks that tries to make sense out of this issue, it's pretty difficult. I mean, you really have to, there's a lot of history and there's a lot of subtle dynamics, and why is this thing a hot button and not this other thing? And it's, I think a lot of it is kind of personality driven I just love kind of watching the way the public reacts when these demagogues sort of hold out the raw meat to them.
And the other part, what is the public? I mean, John Oliver, he has his own audience, but that is not representative of America. I mean, it's fair enough. His folks are motivated and have at it. But, that I come back to why this is a decision for Congress. I mean, I could also say, I can go back to where I'm from. People have not everyone knows John Oliver either. But this is your point, Richard, that, this may be a burning issue for some and it's not for others. And it isn't right that for those who want to impose their view on everyone else. We live in a democracy where we have a necessary competition of ideas and we take votes on things.
Well, eventually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's always an interest in sort of having the issue be alive for the next election. But,
right.
I think there ought to be a sunset on, after you've talked about an issue for, say, 15 years, there should just be like a, you have to decide it and move on.
Right.
But anyway, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
I think this has really been informative. I really love hearing about what's going on in other countries. This really isn't something that Americans really know that much about or even probably care that much about as we should. But 50 different countries have gotten their parliament to sign up for a net neutrality law, and we can't even, get it a committee hearing here in the U.S.
That's something. Well, I would also say if people want to have more inspiration, they can go to mercatus.org and look my name up, and I talk about the Danish telecom policy, alternatives to regulation, and it goes back 20 to 30 years. of how they have used a multi-party political process to make a very viable telecom policy. There is a role for the government with regard to the digital society. I discussed that. I discussed the process to dismantle the telecom regulator. I talk about the Net Neutrality Forum. There was an industry-led group that involved the regulator, involved the community of stakeholders who are interested in this issue. So the interesting thing is there's been so much. I remember we've had a lot of the wars about the broadband speeds and so on, and everyone's saying, oh, these other countries are so better. Well, let's actually look at some of the policies then on net neutrality, because they have taken a very different path than the way the U.S. has gone. And if it's good for the goose, good for the gander. So you need to, folks should have a look at that as well. So that paper is, again, mercatus.org, and goes into a lot of those things.
Okay, that's great. Thanks a lot for joining us. And folks, this is the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. If you listen to this podcast on iTunes, you can give us a review. And if you listen to it from the blog, you can leave us a comment. We do these on at least every month, sometimes more frequently. I think we're in a more frequently phase right now, because there's so many sort of burning issues going on that we're trying to help folks understand. But come back and see us again. So Richard Bennett, signing off.